Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, U.S. officials confirm the Zika virus is sexually transmitted. How can Muslim and non-Muslim relations be improved?
Once you roll up your sleeves and actually work on a project together, on an effort, can you really see the values of your brothers and sisters of different faiths?
Another player in the race for the White House drops out, and the rock band Coldplay appears in one of the greatest gigs around. It's right here on The Voice of America. U.S. officials have confirmed the transmission of the Zika virus by sexual contact. Officials in Dallas, Texas say a person was infected with Zika after having sexual contact with a sick individual who returned from a country where the virus was present. Dr. Lisis Margissis is the Senior Director of Infection Control at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. International Edition's Sarah Williams asked her to describe the causes of the recent outbreak and the added concern about sexual contact causing the virus.
Well, the cause of the Zika virus outbreak is really transmission of a virus via mosquitoes. And there are several examples of viruses that are transmitted in this way by mosquitoes, and this is very similar to other things that we've seen, like West Nile virus and dengue and other pathogens. So in that respect, the Zika virus is very similar to other things we've seen before. You're right that the recent reports of sexual transmission of the Zika virus are of concern and are somewhat different from these other pathogens that I just mentioned, because that indicates another way that the virus can be spread. There are only a very small number of reports of this so far, so I don't think we should become overly alarmed at this point, but investigation will have to be ongoing about that potential. The supposition would be that during the acute phase of infection, that there was enough virus around that it was able to be transmitted sexually in that case.
Why is this a virus? Why can this be so devastating to infants?
So the Zika virus itself is a fairly mild, self-limited illness and wasn't of great concern for that reason until this association was noticed with these terrible congenital abnormalities that have now been tentatively associated both geographically and temporally to Zika virus infection. When a pregnant woman acquires the infection, that infection in her bloodstream can be transmitted to the fetus, and it is believed that that may be the mechanism that causes neurologic abnormalities and congenital defects like we're seeing.
Now, how can people avoid this? You know, I'm thinking particularly of childbearing age women. What lengths do people have to do to, you know, if they're considering having a child, to avoid this?
Right. Well, the greatest risk, because of the congenital abnormalities, the greatest risk of this virus right now is acquiring it while you are pregnant. And so that's why the warnings really are for women who are currently pregnant or who are actively considering becoming pregnant or may be in early stages of pregnancy, to really take extreme caution. This involves being careful to avoid the possibility of exposure, if at all possible, and that involves consideration of whether you really need to travel to the areas where there's active ongoing transmission. If you are living in one of those areas or traveling to one of the areas, then it involves really avoiding mosquito bites. And mosquitoes are the vectors for many pathogens, so I think, you know, the message about avoiding mosquito bites applies to many pathogens, not just Zika. So that's things like insect repellents, trying to avoid areas that have a lot of mosquitoes, staying indoors in air conditioning when possible, wearing long sleeves or long clothing, some of which can be treated to repel mosquitoes, and things like that.
Dr. Lisa Margakis is the Senior Director of Infection Control at Johns Hopkins Hospital. For what's being said on the web about this story, we're joined at the anchor desk by social media reporter Andrew Palachewski. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. Well, hashtag Zika virus is trending, and we're still in the early stages of this virus, so a lot of what we're seeing on social media right now is raising awareness and trying to get the tips out there on how to prevent this virus from being contracted and spreading. And it's interesting, the people who are tweeting this, you have the WHO, the World Health Organization, the UN, but I also saw a tweet from Terminix, and that's a pest control company here in the United States, saying here's what you can do to prevent mosquitoes.
It's in their interest to get people to have them come out and spray for mosquitoes.
Right, but it's also in their interest to try to raise awareness and make sure their customers are well enough to call them to get rid of the mosquitoes. So that's was nice to see them doing that. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we're still in this awareness phase. So as the virus spreads and more information comes out, social media will be a very valuable tool. I wouldn't be surprised if at a certain point social media was used to try to track areas where the virus is and try to get more information and resources out to people.
What else is going on, Andrew?
Well, both in the U.S. and worldwide, trending is National Signing Day. Now, this in the U.S. is for college football players, no, not soccer football, American football, but high school students signing letters to go to colleges and play football for them next year. So you have a lot of schools tweeting out saying, we got this player, we got this top recruit, it's going to be a great season, trying to drum up their fans. And also a lot of these students, pictures of them signing these letters, wearing hats and things. And then, of course, the fans very excited. I don't follow American college football. I follow American college basketball, but it's very similar. These recruits are tracked by fans. They will, you know, check on their social media to see as soon as they post what school they're going to, hoping they go to their preferred team. So you see a lot of that. So a lot of excitement and congratulations to all those players who are signing and going off to great careers in football.
We used to have an anchorman out here, and he could not miss a single game, you know, and his emotions would depend on if his team lost. If he came in moping, we knew he'd lost.
And now you can see that around the world on Facebook and Twitter. You can see whether people are happy or people are disappointed.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists theorize that the moon was formed as the result of a collision between an early Earth and a protoplanet known as Theia some 4.5 billion years ago. But they seem to differ on the ferocity of the collision. Some say that Earth sideswiped Theia, while others, including researchers who have just published a study in the journal Science, say that the collision was more of a violent head-on crash. A group of researchers from UCLA examined rocks taken from both the moon by Apollo astronauts and volcanic rocks from the Earth's mantle. The study's lead author, Edward Young, a professor of geochemistry and cosmochemistry, says that identical oxygen chemical signatures in both Earth and moon rocks supports their theory that Earth and Theia had a violent head-on collision. He says if the collision between the two was merely a glancing blow, most of the moon would have been made up of material from Theia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
President Barack Obama today is visiting a mosque in Baltimore County, Maryland. It's the first time he has visited an American mosque as president, and it comes at a time of growing concern about hostilities directed towards Muslim Americans. Zahar Al-Salati is an Iraqi-born Muslim American and leader in the American Muslim community. She also advocates for Muslims from her posts on the Executive Council for the Fellowship of Reconciliation and as a board member of both the Council on American Islamic Relations and Religions for Peace, a United Nations-affiliated NGO. Zahar joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Zahar.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no. With the rise of terrorism, including the graphic videos of beheadings and other brutal acts by ISIS, a lot of criticism has been focused on the Muslim community in general. How can your community counter this general discrimination?
Well, probably the best thing that we can do is be the best representatives and the best examples of what our faith calls us to do. Our faith is a reminder of the messages of Christianity and Judaism, the messages of mercy, compassion, loyalty, and striving for justice for humanity. And although it is a small portion that has twisted the ideology of Islam, it is rather unfortunate that the rest of the 1.5 billion Muslims around the world are called to continuously apologize and react to the acts of a few.
Some criticize senior members of the Muslim community for not speaking out strongly enough against terrorism. Is this your opinion?
Well, you know, actually, I'm very thankful for you to allow me to come here, because a lot of times the media is quite silent on a lot of the actions and the activism that we do to counter this terrorism. There have been major fetwas by leading Muslim leaders around the world. The Shia scholars in Najaf, the holiest city, have put out fetwas against extremism. Leaders in Egypt and Al-Azhar have put out, quite a lot of statements countering the twisted ideology that these extremists do. Numerous organizations here in D.C. alone. I mean, as a matter of fact, this week, several Muslim organizations from around the world are getting together to denounce terrorism. But unfortunately, you don't hear a lot of the good work that Muslims are doing to counter that.
Well, what can be done to improve relations between the Muslim and non-Muslim communities?
I think the biggest thing is to get to know your neighbor. I happen to live currently in an intentional multi-faith community where Muslim, Jews, and Christians live together and work together for social justice. If you know, Muslims are not new to the landscape of America. You know, the first Muslims that came here were slaves, back in the 14, 15, 1600s. So we are very much a part of the tapestry of the American society. You cannot go and not find a Muslim in most public service sectors around the country. You cannot go to a hospital and not find a physician or a physician's assistant. You cannot go to an engineering firm or to an institute of higher education and not find a Muslim. Just look right around, look over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. You'll find a teacher, a taxi driver, somebody that's in your PTA. And it's just a matter of visiting your mosque or inviting the youth groups to get together. That's the best way to get to know one another and to help each other in projects of community service. Because once you roll up your sleeves and actually work on a project together, on an effort, can you really see the values of your brothers and sisters of different faiths?
Thank you so much, Sahar, and have a nice visit to Washington.
Oh, thank you so much, and God bless.
Coming up on International Edition, another change in the run for the White House. And Coldplay will get a warm welcome at the Super Bowl. With the Iowa caucuses behind them, the U.S. presidential candidates are now focusing their attention on the northeastern state of New Hampshire, where they will once again turn to a round of debates and appearances to make their cases before voters make their choice on Tuesday. One of the candidates, Republican Senator from Kentucky Rand Paul, is stepping out of the race. And joining me to talk about that is national correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, Jim, do you think Rand Paul dropping out is not much of a surprise after his showing in Iowa?
Right. I think people thought maybe Rand Paul would try to hang in until New Hampshire. Rand Paul is a hero to what we call libertarians, people who don't want much government involvement in their lives. And that's a big strain of thought in New Hampshire. But look, here's the political reality. He did a very poor finish in Iowa. The fundraising wasn't there. And the prospects in New Hampshire were not looking good because it's a very crowded field still. And now we're finally getting to the point where some of these Republicans are dropping by the wayside. Mike Huckabee after Iowa, now Rand Paul.
Are the approaches by the big players to this race, are they changing now that the Iowa caucuses are?
Yeah, it will be a change because New Hampshire's a different type of voter, okay? In Iowa, the driving force for Ted Cruz winning was what we call evangelical Christian conservative voters, very committed to their faith, very committed to going out and voting for true conservatives on social issues in the caucus. Well, New Hampshire's different. I grew up in Massachusetts. It's a different type of feel there. It's more secular. The religious angle is not as prominent. There are a lot of conservatives in New Hampshire. Don't forget their state motto is live free or die. They don't like the government involved. So it's more about taxes, regulation, and allowing the freedom of the individual. And so whoever plays on that is going to do well. And Marco Rubio, coming in a strong third in Iowa, sets himself up for a real opportunity in New Hampshire.
So what are we going to see in New Hampshire?
Well, the overall on the Republican side, the story is still Donald Trump. We can't forget him. Disappointed with his finish in Iowa, number two. And also, by the way, he's still complaining about losing to Ted Cruz. He says Cruz and his people committed fraud. We'll see where that goes. But in terms of New Hampshire, Trump's had a pretty good lead in the polls. The question between now and next Tuesday is, can a Rubio, Chris Christie, John Kasich or Jeb Bush catch fire and make a move. They're all bunched together in the polls. So you have Trump way ahead and the rest of them bunched up. I think what we're going to see is more of a sorting out of the field in New Hampshire.
And what about the Democrats?
Democrats, good question. Now, we had a very airtight race in Iowa. Sanders did surprisingly well. Well, guess what? Bernie Sanders has had a pretty big lead in New Hampshire for a while, double digits. So if you're Hillary Clinton, what do you do? She wants to close the gap, probably not going to win. But here is Clinton's ace in the hole. After New Hampshire, it goes to Nevada, heavy Latino voting group, and then to South Carolina, where African-American voters weigh in numbers. That should help Clinton because she has strong support in the minority community. So Sanders should have a good night on Tuesday in New Hampshire. He's from neighboring Vermont. But Clinton's looking down the long game, and she expects to do well in some of the upcoming primaries.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Always a pleasure.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
We're making yoga really accessible for a lot of people that normally wouldn't set foot in a yoga studio. We get a lot of people that are brand new to yoga, have never tried it before. A lot of people that get bribed to be here with beer on the agenda.
That's right. Instructor Sheila Davis said beer. She's teaching a yoga class at Florida's Miami Brewing Company.
Right back into Downward Facing Dog. It's okay to moan.
Practitioners tout yoga's benefits for improved flexibility, muscle strength, and tone, but the people taking this class admit they're here for different reasons.
I did it because the girlfriend wanted me to come and free beer.
The girls usually love the yoga and the men usually love the craft beer, so this is a way to get both of them together at the same time and to do it as a couple and enjoy it. And the men who don't think they love yoga may love it in the end.
Yoga and craft beer are both expanding industries in the United States. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
There's a rather famous band called Coldplay, and if you haven't heard them somehow before, you will hear them when you watch the Super Bowl, because they are going to be halftime entertainment. And it's supposed to be a big thing, and big things, Larry London comes to our studio to talk about.
Hi, I'm
Larry.
A big thing.
You are not a big
thing. Widen the door. Well, last year's Super Bowl set a record at halftime with 121 million viewers watching Katy Perry. So we'll see how Coldplay fares. And they've added a special attraction, a guest star.
Who's that?
Beyonce.
Oh, wow. You would think it would be the other way around. I mean, Beyonce is so big on her own.
She's huge. And, you know, Destiny's Child made a guest appearance at the Super Bowl a few years ago. Now, the reason she's coming on the show is because she also sings music on Coldplay's brand new album.
Oh.
So it made sense for them to invite her and to also, you know, to bolster up the audience, as they say. When Coldplay started, they were known as Starfish. And then they changed their name in 2000, and that's when they achieved success with their very first hit, which is called Yellow. And they are back now with their seventh new album. And that came out in 2015, and it's called A Head Full of Dreams. All right, well, here's a song called Adventure of a Lifetime.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to some of that.
Turn your magic on, with me she'd say, everything you want to dream away. We are legends every day. We are diamonds, and I feel my heart beating. I feel my heart underneath my skin. I feel my heart beating. You make me feel like I'm alive again.
Tell us a little bit about them, okay?
Okay, sure. They announced a tour that's going to begin very soon. It's going to be their first tour since 2011's Milo Xyloto tour. And
what does that mean?
I don't know. I really have no, don't ask me that. I don't know. But I do know this, that Chris Martin was married to Gwyneth Paltrow, and she also sings on the new album. And so does his new girlfriend. So Chris Martin's just inviting anybody that walks by to sing on the new album. Now, this is a band that's won 62 awards, including 5 MTV Awards, 7 Grammy Awards, and 8 Brit Awards. You asked me, is this an older band? And actually, no, Chris Martin is quite young, and they have a mass appeal. They reach a younger audience, and they do appeal to the middle-aged folks as well. They have a great sound. If you like rock music and you like pop rock,
That's exactly what Coldplay is all about. And they put out some great songs over the years.
What about the show that goes on with the music during halftime? They're going to have the fireworks and all that business going on.
You know, they keep that very, very close-lipped. They do not talk about what they're doing. They want people to tune in. Pepsi sponsoring the halftime show. And so, you know, it's going to be a big production. And usually they give about 15 minutes or so for the halftime performance. So the band has to make the most of it. And I'm sure that Beyonce won't be the only guest appearance. They've had Tom Petty on in the past, and quite a few other performers have done. Bruno Mars was on and attracted a huge audience. So, you know, every year they try to outdo the previous year, and we all know about the wardrobe malfunction, which Janet Jackson.
Yes.
And so hopefully there will be no wardrobe malfunctions with Coldplay.
Uh-huh. Well, people will be tuning in to hear Coldplay, but also there's those advertisements. Everybody always loves to see those during the Super Bowl.
$5 million for 30 seconds of airtime.
Well, let's hope the game is good, too.
Yes. Denver and Carolina. It's going to be an interesting game. This is probably Peyton Manning's last game.
Oh, that's too bad. I like him. Older
no
guy.
No better way to go out than in the Super Bowl, though.
Okay. Well, thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Susan.
Like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The peace process in Colombia is at a pivotal stage. During Colombian President Manuel Santos' upcoming visit to Washington, both President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will meet with him to hear President Santos' analysis of the peace process and how the United States can support Colombia's transition into a new post-peace accord era. For more than 50 years, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, have been fighting their country's government. During that time, more than 220,000 people have been killed and more than 6 million have been displaced. Large numbers of Colombians have been kidnapped, forcibly recruited as children, or subjected to sexual violence. With U.S. support, Plan Colombia was launched in 2000. Under that initiative, the United States worked with officials in Bogota to help the country's armed forces and police become more professional, to ensure that they could effectively provide security and fight crime while also protecting human rights. But law and order, said Secretary Kerry in a recent op-ed, is only part of the equation. With support from the United States, Colombians moved ahead on multiple fronts to improve governance, reform the judiciary, enhance opportunities for Afro-Colombian and indigenous groups, provide support for the victims of conflict, and extend protections to journalists and civil society. Having helped Colombia create the conditions for a peace accord, the United States plans to further assist Colombia in seizing the promise that peace affords. President Obama will soon present to the U.S. Congress a successor strategy aimed at further enhancing security gains, cracking down on trade and illegal drugs, ensuring transitional justice and help for victims, and providing the means for economic recovery in areas once controlled by the FARC. As with the original plan, said Secretary Kerry, Colombians themselves will bear most of the cost, but unique U.S. capabilities can help them win the peace. No peace accord will bring back the many lives lost across Colombia over the past half century. But Colombians now have a historic opportunity to embrace a future free from conflict and violence, and the United States has good reason to stand by their side.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.